Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a bit of a literary mystery. With the hoopla surrounding the Woody Guthrie Centennial, historian Douglas Brinkley and actor Johnny Depp wrote a New York Times article about a newly rediscovered manuscript novel by Guthrie. Well, this is no mystery to the librarians of the University of Tulsa Special Collections, as the manuscript has been a part of their collection since the mid-1980s. But how it got to McFarland Library? Well, that's the mystery. House of Earth is a semi-autobiographical story of a Dust Bowl-era farming couple trying to eke out a living on the West Texas High Plains as the ground beneath them literally shifts and, in fact, blows away. House of Earth reflects Guthrie's mistrust of moneyed interest along with a quite lusty exploration of sexuality. In fact, Depp and Brinkley write that the novel offers a searing portrait of the Panhandle and its marginalized Great Depression residents, and that he successfully mixes Steinbeck's narrative verve with D.H. Lawrence's openness to erotic exploration. We thought it'd be interesting to talk with the director of Special Collections about the Woody Guthrie manuscript as well as the other collections they hold. Mark Carlson is my guest. Mark Carlson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So how did this Woody Guthrie manuscript end up here in Tulsa in the University of Tulsa Special Collections? Do we have any idea?
Actually, no. We have some good ideas on how it probably arrived. Unfortunately, in the past, records were not always kept the way we keep them today. And particularly during the period I think we acquired this, a lot of the acquisitions were being done through the provost's office and the president's office directly, and so we may not have that paperwork in our special collections files, and I haven't had time really to go through the old presidential papers, which have never been processed, and the provost's papers, so that we can hopefully find some sign.
So this sort of came into the special collections with no fanfare, no idea that, well, this is a Woody Guthrie material, this is important, or anything. It just showed up.
At the time that it was acquired, Guthrie was, if you were in the folk scene, he was important. Mm-hmm. But in Oklahoma, he was not so important.
In fact, the legacy, as you well know, was mm-hmm. sort of played down for a lot of times because of the political leaning, his political leanings and things like that.
Well, one of the things that the reason we acquired it ultimately was because we were in the process of negotiating the acquisition of the Woody Guthrie Archive originally. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in 1985, when the final time to actually sign the paperwork came about, our collecting direction had shifted. And there was a feeling between the president and my predecessor at the time that it wasn't what we needed right now. It had nothing to do with his politics. It actually had to do with a misunderstanding about literature and songs. We had no objection to owning Guthrie's manuscripts for his books, but the other material wasn't really.
At that time, the University of Tulsa was very much focused on English expatriate writers, on late Romantic, early modern writers.
We were building our modernist collections uh-huh. and really focusing on the literature. So there were a lot of things that at that point we had been collecting previously that just sort of were set aside. And whether for good or ill, that's not really our issue right now. It just happened.
But somehow, out of that negotiation, you think that this manuscript was given as sort of what, maybe?
Actually, that was one of the options, was that it was given. I've recently run across a piece of documentation that says it was probably not. My original thought is that it had been given during the original negotiations between Dr. Logsdon and Harold Leventhal, who was Guthrie's agent and literary executive.
And we should mention Guy Logsdon was the historian of the university. Was he also involved with the library?
He was the library director for many years.
And, of course, he is a major figure in Woody Guthrie and
absolutely
just the whole folk tradition as well.
Yeah. And I knew that he had actually explained to me that some of the Leventhal materials had come to us as kind of a
teaser for
teaser.
The main, yeah.
And I had thought that this might be where this came from. I have since realized that, no, in 84, we actually made a research copy for Leventhal of The House of Earth, which means that he probably didn't have it already.
This is a great archival mystery.
It's a great archival mystery. Most probably we acquired it after the death of a filmmaker named Irving Lerner. And that we had purchased it at that point.
Yeah. At one point, Woody Guthrie was hoping that this manuscript would make a good film, and that's where Lerner came in.
And we know that Lerner had a copy of the manuscript. I have discussed this with the Guthrie Archives, and they think probably that's where the manuscript came out of.
And so now all of a sudden this manuscript has become important. You have Johnny Depp and Douglas Brinkley touting it in the New York Times. And there's talk of this actually becoming a book finally after all these years.
I'd be delighted to see it.
Yeah. And so was this just sort of sitting here in Tulsa?
Pretty much, yeah.
In an archive, huh? Nobody, the university really didn't know?
We knew we had it. We just didn't. Historically, advertising our collections has not really been a strength, and we are trying to utilize more modern technologies to do that. I think the folks who are interested in our literary collections were really interested in
Rebecca West, V.S. Naipaul,
And I have some records that show that people did come and use this manuscript, but not very many. And we have lists of all the copies that have been made of it. Which is why I'm reasonably sure that the copy that the Guthrie Archive holds is the copy we made for Leventhal. So when the book was announced, normally we are not informed by reading it in the New York Times. It doesn't usually happen that way. We usually know about it long in advance. But in this case, this is how it has happened, and we have been throwing our whole support behind it.
Now, you actually have drafts as well, as a manuscript. So this is in a three-ring binder like you would have done in the 1940s.
It was in a three-ring binder. We actually have retained the binder as well because he wrote all over it. It's part of the manuscript, but actually keeping the pages in the binder is not archivally sound.
So, but this is how it came in, a three-ring binder, the way you would do a manuscript, say, in the 1940s.
Sure.
You know, one page, one after the
other. Absolutely.
But you also have two earlier drafts as well.
We have earlier drafts of the first chapter, as well as another short story.
Interesting.
Which I would like to also see get published.
Now, I understand that this novel, one of the inspirations for this was he had gone to New Mexico and he saw how well the adobe building in New Mexico had stood up to dust storms and the like.
I think so, yes. And he had a
how-to guide on how to build an adobe house.
And I think he actually spent some time trying to live in. So this is a semi-autobiographical novel, although from what I can read of it, I've never actually read the whole thing myself since I don't have time to read everything we own. From what I understand, it definitely fictionalizes the accounts tremendously, but I suspect the concept of how it's going on, the experience is there.
He spent some time in Pampas, Texas during the Dust Bowl, saw it firsthand, and the story is a Dust Bowl story of a fictional couple in West Texas, and it's very much focusing on his political philosophy at the time, railing against capitalists that are keeping him in poverty and, you know, shoddy home construction.
Absolutely.
And the house of earth is, you know, the sort of, I guess, this dream to be able to survive what the land was doing at that time.
I will be very interested to compare it with the other great Dust Bowl piece that came out recently, the Worst Hard Time, which...
Right. Mm-hmm. Tim Egan.
Tim Egan. And I'm looking forward to doing a comparison to see kind of Guthrie's experience versus the experiences of others who lived
and recollections.
And recollections.
Yeah, because that was written 50 years later. That will be interesting. But I guess it never got published because by the time he wrote the book, you know, the Dust Bowl was over, the Depression was over, and the politics of it probably were a little bit untenable at that particular point. Late 40s?
It's possible that the politics was starting to be an issue. I think possibly his health may have actually been starting to affect him about that time also. But he may have just figured out that this was not the right time for this. Mm-hmm. I know that in the late 90s, Harold Leventhal again tried to republish the novel. I don't know why that didn't go through. We were in support of that at that point too.
So this has been a known quantity by the university throughout its history. It's just that nobody seemed to have interest until the centennial.
Yeah, no, it just we'd started having visitors come and actually look at it as the Kaiser Foundation was looking at trying to procure the actual archive. And so that brought in people who were really wanting to see this unknown piece. Mm-hmm. In the Guthrie world, some people knew it existed. A lot of people didn't, apparently.
My guest today is Mark Carlson. He was the director of the University of Tulsa's McFarland Library Special Collections, which is the university's sort of special documents. It includes a lot of papers by famous writers, all sorts of collections. And, of course, the New York Times article has highlighted the fact that this 1947 manuscript by Woody Guthrie has resided in the TU Special Collections. We thought it'd be a great idea to talk about Special Collections. So what exactly make up the Special Collections? I know in the mid-80s, early 90s, it was very much focused on British expatriate, sort of late romantic, the Rebecca West, the V.S. Naipaul.
19th and 20th century British and American authors. Mm-hmm. V.S. Naipaul was sort of an exploration into the field of colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
Again, under a provost at that point who had an interest in...
Now, I'm sure V.S. Naipaul is still working. Is he still contributing to this archive?
We own everything he writes.
Wow.
Physical piece. Mm-hmm.
Does it come shipped over every couple
of
years?
Every so often we'll get a shipment, and we'll add it more to the collection.
Now, do you have very many living writers where you have their archives like this?
We have a few. Most of them do tend to be... We tend to get their collections very late in their lives. Mm-hmm. One of the collections we acquired very recently was Katie Wentworth, who is a local right. science fiction fantasy mm-hmm. author. Her death was actually a surprise to everybody, and I know she had been planning on actually coming in and arranging the collection herself, which would have been really useful. The collections that come from living people, we have at least a better chance of getting how they would have arranged it. As opposed to waiting for, we try not to do an artificial construction. We try to stick with the author's filing systems and how they think, because you want it as a representative of who they are and how their processes work.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always work, but we do have a few still living. Richard Murphy, for example, is still alive.
An Irish poet,
and we have a great deal of his material. I have been actually emailing back and forth with him recently about a work he is currently dealing with. And we pretty much own everything he writes, too. Mm-hmm. So,
But the focus of Special Collections has shifted, I assume, as the administration of the library changes, as Special Collection directors change. And so give us a sense of some of the things you wouldn't really expect to see in a library that are a part of Special Collections.
Well, the Special Collections currently maintains a smaller library of over 150,000 volumes. We have over 8,000 shelf feet of manuscripts, documents, paintings, pottery, other artwork, photographs. And one of the things we acquired, just for an example, is in 2008, we acquired the Bob McCormick Photographic Archive. Bob McCormick was a Tulsa photographer for many years and is extremely well known in town.
He was the society photographer for, any special
Absolutely.
Event, Bob McCormick and McCormick Studios were there. So you have this living document of
exactly
what Tulsa was like through the years and who was prominent and who's who of really, who's
and,
lived here in Tulsa.
And who's who. And that's actually one of the major reasons we acquired it, is we also acquired a few months before that the... archive of another Tulsa photographer, a man named Bjarne Holm, who is, he's more lower middle class,
okay.
that social level of photographer. And between the two of them, we should be able to, in 100 years, demonstrate who was living in Tulsa in the late 20th century. And so we're very excited about that. Now, of course, with McCormick, he took a lot of historical photos as well, not simply portraiture. Mm-hmm. And those are the photos we're really focusing on right now. The portraits, because so many of the people involved are still alive, and really, quite honestly, the photographic studio is still in business,
mm-hmm.
We have tried to stay fairly hands-off on the portraiture side and have been focusing more on the historical photos. Because that's really, I think, what people are really going to be interested in the short term.
And this is something you have to think about as a collection director, mm-hmm. is not only what people would be interested in researching today, but what they may be interested in researching 50, 100 years from now.
Exactly. And with the McCormick Archive, it skews all of our figures when we start talking about, well, X amount of the percentage is literature. And the McCormick Archive, when we unboxed it, was 18 tons of prints and negatives. And other equipment. And mostly it's the silver nitrate film that's right. So heavy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we're expecting, estimates are somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million images.
Now, obviously, at some point you would want to digitize all of this. Is that ongoing?
That's the plan. We are gradually getting them digitized. We have other collections to digitize as well. So we have to sort of shift priorities. And so we have been working on getting them at least usably digital. And this is an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm. Now, this has been a recent focus, sort of focusing on Tulsa history.
Yes.
You go back prior to the focus on English expatriate writers and that era of English and late Romantic writers. There was a great deal of emphasis on folk material and Native American materials.
It all grows out of the same. We actually liken the Tulsa materials, and we have always maintained some contacts of picking up local materials whenever possible. It has never been a focus, though. Prior to the shift to modernism, the library director, Guy Logsdon, and the first real head of special collections, David Farmer, really did try and acquire. I think the goal was stated to be to make this the best special collections for the region, which means there was a lot of Tulsa material there also. And that's where all the Native American material showed up and a lot of the other collections.
Give us a sense of what the Native American collections are at the library.
We have an extensive amount of Cherokee material, for example, both in Cherokee syllabary materials as well as governmental documents from the past. One of our lesser known pieces is actually the Cherokee Council minutes, I think from 1796.
Wow.
Which are in English.
Interesting.
Because that's the language that was being used by the council at that time. And we also have pre-Columbian pottery, Mississippian era pottery.
I've been through the special collections mm-hmm. and some of the storage areas once mm-hmm. upon a time, and there's lots of pottery there.
You need to come back. We've redecorated. And yes, we have.
And at that point, it was not a serious issue of a collection they were actively exploring at the time.
No.
So it was, I'm glad to hear that it's being well taken care of.
We are trying to take care of it. And actually we are trying to work out ways to make it more accessible in the future. One of the collections we are actively working on right now is also the collection of Mexican burial figurines and pottery that are about 2,500 years old, 1,500 to 2,500 years old. That we have scholars who are actively wanting to examine those and work with them. And we also will occasionally have used them occasionally for classes, for educational purposes, which is one of our major reasons for being here.
Hmm. Now, you also have a number of collectors who you have worked with locally. Mm-hmm. I can think of the late Ben Hennecke. He was a big collector of circus material and like early performance material, like having to do with early theatrical traditions,
theatrical ephemera. We also have all of his material on his biography, Road of Laura Keene. In mm-hmm. fact, we have, we don't have a Ben Hennecke collection. We have five. And they're all from different things. We have his presidential papers as a mm-hmm. separate issue. Or as a separate collection, and most of the material is, we're looking forward to getting it more processed. Mostly our major issues are we have so much material and so few people to work with.
And I know that in the case of Ben, it was like whatever his interest was at that time, he was very active.
Absolutely.
In either acquiring material or, doing his own research, well into his 80s. I know he was trapping around Italy and going around learning about tapestries and things like that. And
I think he was still working on researching stuff until shortly before his death.
Mm-hmm.
And his last book, The Ravenna Mosaic, was an interesting examination of some of the materials he'd found in Italy. He did try to teach us. When I started up there in 2005, I had many lengthy conversations with him, partly to find out the histories of some of the things. One of the major goals I have is trying to track down the histories of where things came from, how things happened. And he was extremely useful at that. And one of the things he tried to teach me was how donors feel about their stuff. So he was very well still focused on his materials and wanting to see the collections grow.
My guest today is Mark Carlson, the director of the University of Tulsa's McFarland Library Special Collections. The McFarland Library Special Collections made news around the country because it was revealed in an article in the New York Times that Douglas Brinkley and Johnny Depp, in writing this article, are sort of championing this 1947 manuscript by Woody Guthrie of a novel titled House of Earth, which they hope to have published in the mm-hmm. next year. And, of course, it's been residing here in Tulsa in the special collections. You brought up an interesting point of ownership. When we think of art museums, we think of provenance like artworks
yes.
being very much an important issue. And, in fact, as you can see from like European artworks that were looted by the Nazis, I mean, this is ongoing litigation. And what's interesting, as the collectible markets have really expanded, I think you're seeing the same issues of provenance sort of expanded to things like, literary archives.
Provenance is a major problem for us because, again, in the past, we kept as good a records as were being kept by pretty much anybody at that point.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's the libraries has not been an issue of provenance in past years, which all of a sudden now it is.
And now it's becoming more of one because people are expecting more because of the museum world. With us, one of the issues we have is frequently our booksellers and the people we purchase from, they don't tell us where they got their material. And so trying to piece together who got this from where is sometimes just dead impossible.
You have to think of it as people who go to Gardner's bookstore or a used bookstore, buy a book, it goes mm-hmm. into their library for 15, 20 years. All of a sudden, it's part of this archive that you receive. How are you going to know about that original purchase and where it was before it went to that used bookstore?
And
it's almost impossible.
And one of the other issues that occurs, and I had this explained to me by one of our major book dealers that several years ago we had an episode of we had purchased a logbook from a World War I vessel, and in the processing of it, we discovered that William and Mary listed this logbook for these years from this vessel. And my immediate thought was, this isn't good. So I went to my book dealer, and he had acquired it from a picker who just got it from someplace. Mm-hmm. And so my thought was, this could be issuey. So we contacted William and Mary, and they said, no, ours is sitting on the shelf.
Interesting.
And I thought, okay, this I have to see. So I wound up going to Williamsburg for something else, and I took it and took a copy, a digital copy of ours, and sat down and did a page-by-page comparison. We have the rough draft.
The rough draft.
And
interesting.
I didn't know you did that with logbooks, but apparently you do. And so it turned out very well, but it became very difficult of, okay, did this just show up at a garage sale someplace? Or, did somebody lift it? We have to be careful about that because we don't want to be picking up other people's property. And more, we don't want other people picking up our property.
And you think of libraries as, you think of the public collections and how, somebody can grab a volume and out the door it goes.
Oh, that never happens.
I would imagine that in special collections, that's been known to happen, not necessarily yours, but it happens at all special collections.
To the best of my knowledge, it has never happened to us. I would like to keep it that way. But yes, it does occasionally happen. And for us, one of the things we are very focused on is security. And we try very hard to keep it from happening. But when it does, if you have everything properly cataloged and everything clearly identified, it makes it much easier to try and track these things later. But it would be helpful if you could actually be able to trace where you got it. Because,
You look at, like, there's been a number of court cases with people working at the National Archives who have ended up just taking wholesale documents, tried to sell them on the open market,
all of a sudden.
And if you're the buyer of that, it's not really yours, even though you paid good money for it.
And if that logbook had actually turned out to have been stolen, it would have gone back to William and Mary, and a lot of people would have lost money on the way. Because, you buy it in good faith that what you are getting is totally legitimate.
All right. So. My guest today is Mark Carlson, director of the University of Tulsa's McFarland Library Special Collections. You've sort of illuminated a lot of the different collections, everything from literature to World War I vessel logbooks. Is there any way for the public to just sort of see what's in the University of Tulsa's attic, so to speak?
Absolutely. Unlike the rest of the library, which is restricted access, we're open to the public. And we are open 8 to 5, Monday through Friday.
Usually people have to you need to know what they're looking for, but do
it
you
helps
do
if they
little,
do,
little
they
exhibits from time to time?
We do little exhibits. We are currently doing an exhibit on World War I pilots and flying in the war. I believe we are planning our next exhibit up in the upstairs. We do actually have a blog. We have a web presence of sorts. You can go to our website, take a look at the finding aids that are online, and hopefully get an idea of some of the more generally used materials.
All right. Well, Mark Carlson, a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us. Mark Carlson is the director of the University of Tulsa's McFarland Library Special Collections, which holds the manuscript of the 1947 novel by Woody Guthrie, House of Earth. A recent New York Times article touted its rediscovery and hopes to publish the novel next year. For more information about the special collections at McFarland Library, visit utulsa.edu/libraries/McFarland/special collections. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The Summertime Starlight Concert Series offers its final performance of the season on Tuesday night, July 24th at 8 p.m. at the River West Festival Park on the west bank of the Arkansas River in Tulsa. This time around, the Starlight Jazz Orchestra will offer a Sinatra tribute. As always, the event is free and open to the public, and you can learn more about this concert and about the entire 2012 series of Starlight shows at starlightbands.net.